Disc 18.
On the day I met with Sharif, I also signed an executive order placing economic sanctions on the Taliban, freezing its assets and prohibiting commercial exchanges. Around this time, with Sharif's support, U.S. officials also began to train 60 Pakistani troops as commandos to go into Afghanistan to get bin Laden. I was skeptical about the project. Even if Sharif wanted to help, the Pakistani military was full of Taliban and Al-Qaeda sympathizers. But I thought we had nothing to lose by exploring every option. The day after the Sharif meeting, I started the New Markets Tour beginning in Hazard, Kentucky, with a large delegation including several business executives, congressmen, cabinet members, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, and Al Fromm. I was glad that Jackson was making the tour, and that we were starting in Appalachia, America's poorest all-white area. Jesse had long worked to bring more private sector investment to poor areas, and we had grown even closer during the impeachment year, when he had strongly supported my whole family and made a special effort to reach out to Chelsea. From Kentucky, we traveled to Clarksdale, Mississippi, East St. Louis, Illinois, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, a Hispanic neighborhood in Phoenix, Arizona, and the Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles. Even though America had had 2 years of unemployment rates just above 4%, all the communities I visited, and many like them, suffered from unemployment that was far higher than that and per capita incomes well below the national average. The unemployment rate at Pine Ridge was over 70%, yet everywhere we went, I met intelligent, hard-working people who were capable of contributing much more to the economy. I thought doing more to get investment into these areas was both the right thing to do and economically smart. We were already enjoying the largest economic expansion in history with a rapidly growing rate of productivity. It seemed to me that there were three ways to continue to increase growth without inflation: sell more products and services overseas, increase the workforce participation of particular populations, like welfare recipients, and bring growth to new markets in America where investment was too low and unemployment too high. We were doing well in the first two areas with more than 250 trade agreements and welfare reform. And we had made a good start on the third, with more than 130 empowerment zones and enterprise communities, community development banks, and aggressive enforcement of the Community Reinvestment Act. But too many communities had been left behind. I was putting together a legislative proposal to increase available capital to inner cities, rural towns, and Indian reservations by $15 billion. Since it would promote free enterprise, I hoped to get strong bipartisan support and was encouraged by the fact that Speaker Hastert seemed especially interested in the effort. On July 15th, Ehud and Nava Barak accepted an invitation to spend the night at Camp David with Hillary and me. We had an enjoyable dinner, and Ehud and I stayed up talking until nearly 3 in the morning. It was clear that he wanted to complete the peace process and believed that his big election victory gave him a mandate to do so. He was interested in doing something substantive at Camp David, especially after I showed him the building where most of the negotiations President Carter mediated between Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin had taken place in 1978. At the same time, I was also occupied with trying to get the Northern Ireland peace process back on track. There was a deadlock caused by a disagreement between Sinn Féin and the Unionists over whether the IRA's decommissioning could occur after the new government was formed or had to come before it. I explained the situation to Barak, who was intrigued by the differences and similarities between the Irish problems and his own. The next day, John Kennedy Jr., his wife Carolyn, and her sister Lauren were killed when the small plane John was flying crashed off the coast of Massachusetts. I had liked John ever since I had met him in the 1980s when he was a law student working as an intern in Mickey Cantor's firm in Los Angeles. He had come to one of my first New York campaign events in 1991, and not long before they perished, I had enjoyed showing Carolyn and John the residence floors of the White House. Ted Kennedy gave another magnificent eulogy for a fallen family member. Like his father, he had every gift. On July 23rd, King Hassan II of Morocco died at the age of 70. He had been an ally of the United States and a supporter of the Middle East peace process, and I had enjoyed a good personal relationship with him. Again, on short notice, President Bush agreed to fly to Morocco for the funeral with Hillary, Chelsea, and me. I walked behind the King's horse-drawn casket with President Mubarak, Yasser Arafat, Jacques Chirac, and other leaders on a 3-mile route through downtown Rabat. Well over 1 million people lined the streets, ululating and shouting in grief and respect to their fallen monarch. The deafening din of the huge, emotional throng made the march one of the most incredible events I had ever participated in. I think Hassan would have approved. After a brief meeting with Hassan's son and heir, King Mohammed VI, I flew home for a couple of days of work, then left again for Sarajevo, where I joined several European leaders as we committed to a stability pact for the Balkans, an agreement to support the region's short-term needs and long-term growth by providing greater access to our markets for Balkan products, working for the inclusion of Southeastern European countries into the WTO, and providing investment funds and credit guarantees to encourage private investment. The rest of the summer flew by as I continued to disagree with the Republicans over the budget and the size and distribution of their proposed tax cut. Dick Holbrooke was finally confirmed as UN ambassador after an unconscionable delay of 14 months, and Hillary moved closer to declaring her Senate candidacy. In August, we took two trips to New York to look for a home. On the 28th, we visited a late 19th century farmhouse with a large addition from 1989 in Chappaqua, about 40 miles from Manhattan. The old part of the house was charming, the new part spacious and full of light. The instant I walked upstairs into the master bedroom, I told Hillary we had to buy the house. It was part of the 1989 addition. It had extra high ceilings with a row of glass doors facing the backyard, and had two huge windows on the other walls. When Hillary asked me why I was so sure, I replied, "Because you're about to start a hard campaign. There'll be some bad days. This beautiful room is bathed in light. You'll wake up every morning in a good humor." Later in August, I traveled to Atlanta to give the Medal of Freedom to President and Mrs. Carter for the extraordinary work they had done as private citizens since leaving the White House. A couple of days later, in a White House ceremony, I gave the award to several other distinguished Americans, including President Ford and Lloyd Benson. The other recipients were civil rights, labor, democracy, and environmental activists. All were less famous than Ford and Benson, but each had made unique and enduring contributions to America. I did a little campaigning, going to Arkansas with Al Gore for meetings with local farmers and black leaders from across the South, and a large fundraiser full of people from my old campaigns. I also spoke and played saxophone at an event for Hillary on Martha's Vineyard, and appeared with her at events in New York, including a stop at the State Fair in Syracuse, where I was right at home with the farmers. I enjoyed campaigning for both Hillary and Al, and I was beginning to look forward to a time when, after a lifetime of being helped by others, I could end my life in politics the way I'd started it, campaigning for other people I believed in. In early September, Henry Cisneros finally resolved his case with independent counsel David Barrett, who had indicted him, unbelievably, on 18 felony counts for understating personal expenses to the FBI during his 1993 interview. On the day before his trial began, Barrett, who knew he had an unwinnable case, offered Cisneros a deal: a guilty plea to one misdemeanor, a $10,000 fine, and no jail time. Henry took it to avoid the crushing legal expense of a long trial. Barrett has spent more than $9 million of the taxpayers' money to torment a good man for 4 years. Just a few weeks earlier, the independent counsel law had expired. Most of September was devoted to foreign policy. Early in the month, Madeleine Albright and Dennis Ross were in Gaza to support Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat as they agreed on the next steps to implement the Y River Accord, approving a port for the Palestinians, a road connecting the West Bank and Gaza, the handover of 11% of the West Bank, and the release of 350 prisoners. Albright and Ross then went to Damascus to urge President Assad to respond to Barak's desire for peace talks with him soon. On the 9th, I made my first trip to New Zealand for the APEC summit. Chelsea went with me while Hillary stayed home to campaign. The big news at the summit involved Indonesia and the support its military had given to the violent suppression of the pro-independence movement in East Timor, a long troubled Roman Catholic enclave in the world's most populous Muslim country. Most of the APEC leaders favored an international peacekeeping mission for East Timor, and Australian Prime Minister John Howard was willing to take the lead. At first, the Indonesians were opposed to it, but soon they would be forced to relent. An international coalition was formed to send troops to East Timor under the leadership of Australia, and I pledged to Prime Minister Howard that I would send a couple of hundred American troops to provide the logistical support our allies needed. I also met with President Zhang to discuss WTO issues, held joint discussions with Kim Dae-jung and Keizo Abuchi to reaffirm our common position in North Korea, and had my first meeting with Boris Yeltsin's new prime minister and chosen successor, Vladimir Putin. Putin presented a stark contrast to Yeltsin. Yeltsin was large and stocky. Putin was compact and extremely fit from years of martial arts practice. Yeltsin was voluble. The former KGB agent was measured and precise. I came away from the meeting believing Yeltsin had picked a successor who had the skills and capacity for hard work necessary to manage Russia's turbulent political and economic life better than Yeltsin now could, given his health problems. Putin also had the toughness to defend Russia's interests and protect Yeltsin's legacy. Before we left New Zealand, Chelsea and I and my staff took some time to enjoy the beautiful country. Prime Minister Jenny Shipley and her husband Burton hosted us in Queenstown, where I played golf with Burton, Chelsea explored caves with the Shipley kids, and several of my staff went bungee jumping off a high bridge. Gene Sperling tried to goad me into trying it, but I told him I'd had about all the free falls I could stand. Our last stop was the International Antarctic Center in Christchurch, America's launching station for our operations in Antarctica. The center contained a large training module in which the frigid conditions of Antarctica were replicated. I went there to highlight the problem of global warming. Antarctica is a great cooling tower for our planet, with ice more than 2 miles thick. A huge chunk of Antarctic ice about the size of Rhode Island had recently broken free as a result of thawing. I released previously classified satellite photos of the continent to aid in studying the changes that were occurring. The biggest thrill of the event for Chelsea and me was the presence of Sir Edmund Hillary, who had explored the South Pole in the 1950s, was the first man to reach the top of Mount Everest, and most important, was the man Chelsea's mother had been named for. Soon after I returned to America, I went to New York to open the last UN General Assembly of the 20th century, urging the delegates to adopt 3 resolutions. To do more to fight poverty and put a human face on the global economy. To increase our efforts to prevent or quickly stop the killing of innocents in ethnic, religious, racial, or tribal conflicts. And to intensify our efforts to prevent the use of nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons by irresponsible nations or terrorist groups. At the end of the month, I got back to domestic affairs, vetoing the latest Republican tax cut because it was too big, too bloated, and put too great a burden on America's economy. Under the budget rules, the bill would have forced large cuts in education, health care, and environmental protection. It would have prevented us from extending the life of the Social Security and Medicare trust funds and from adding a much-needed prescription drug benefit to Medicare. We were going to have a surplus this year of about $100 billion, but the proposed GOP tax cut would cost nearly $1 trillion over a decade. Republicans' justification for it was based on projected surpluses. On this issue, I was far more conservative than they were. If the projections were wrong, the deficits would return, and with them higher interest rates and slower growth. Over the previous 5 years, Congressional Budget Office estimates had been off by an average of 13% a year, though our administration's had been closer to the mark. It was an irresponsible risk. I asked the Republicans to work with the White House and the Democrats in the same spirit that had produced the bipartisan welfare reform bill in 1996 and the Balanced Budget Act in 1997. On September 24th, Hillary and I hosted an event in the old executive office building to celebrate the success of bipartisan efforts to increase the adoption of children out of the foster care system. They had increased almost 30% in the 2 years since our legislation had passed. I paid tribute to Hillary, who had been working on the issue for more than 20 years, and to perhaps the most ardent supporter of the reforms in the House, Tom DeLay, himself an adoptive parent. I would have liked a few more moments like that, but with this one exception, DeLay didn't believe in consorting with the enemy. Partisanship returned in early October when the Senate rejected, on a party-line vote, my nomination of Judge Ronnie White to a federal district judgeship. White was the first African-American man to serve on the Missouri Supreme Court and was a highly regarded judge. He was defeated after Missouri's conservative Senator John Ashcroft, who was in a tough fight for re-election against Governor Mel Carnahan, grossly distorted White's record on the death penalty. White had voted to uphold 70% of the death penalty cases that had come before him. On more than half of those he had voted to reverse, he was part of a unanimous state Supreme Court ruling. Ashcroft got his Republican colleagues to go along with the smear because he thought it would help him and hurt White's supporter, Governor Carnahan, with pro-death penalty voters in Missouri. Ashcroft wasn't alone in completely politicizing the confirmation process. By this time, Senator Jesse Helms had refused for years to allow the Senate to vote on a black judge for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, even though there had never been an African American on the court. And the Republicans wondered why African Americans wouldn't vote for them. Our partisan differences extended even to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which had been supported by every Republican and Democrat president since Eisenhower. The Joint Chiefs were for it, and our nuclear experts said tests weren't necessary to check the reliability of our weapons. But we didn't have the votes of two-thirds of the senators necessary to ratify the treaty, and Trent Lott tried to get me to promise not to raise it for the rest of my term. I couldn't figure out whether the Senate Republicans had really moved that far to the right of their own party's traditional position, or just didn't want to give me another victory. Regardless, their refusal to ratify the Test Ban Treaty weakened America's ability to argue that other nations shouldn't develop or test nuclear weapons. I continued doing political events for Al Gore and the Democrats, including two with gay activists who were strongly supportive of both Al and me because of the substantial number of openly gay and lesbian citizens serving in the administration, and because of our strong support of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and the Hate Crimes Bill, which made crimes committed against people because of their race, disability, or sexual orientation a federal offense. I also went to New York whenever I could to support Hillary. Her likely opponent was New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who was a combative, controversial figure, but was much less conservative than the National Republicans. I had had a cordial relationship with him, largely because of our shared support of the COPS program and gun safety measures. George W. Bush seemed well on his way to winning the Republican nomination as several of his challengers dropped out, leaving only Senator John McCain with any chance of stopping him. I had been impressed with Bush's campaign since I first saw him articulate his compassionate conservative theme in a farm setting in Iowa. I thought it was a brilliant formulation, virtually the only argument he could make to swing voters against an administration with approval ratings in the 65% range. He couldn't dispute the fact that we had 19 million new jobs, the economy was still growing, and crime was down for the 7th year in a row. Instead, his compassionate conservative message to the swing voters was this: I'll give you the same good conditions you have now with a smaller government and a bigger tax cut. Wouldn't you like that? On most issues, Bush was in line with the conservative congressional Republicans, though he had criticized their budget for being harsh to the poor because it raised taxes for low-income Americans by cutting back on the earned income tax credit while reducing taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Although Bush was a formidable politician, I still thought Al Gore would win, despite the fact that only two previous vice presidents, Martin Van Buren and George H.W. Bush, had been elected directly from the vice presidency, because the country was in good shape and our administration had strong support. All vice presidents who run for president have two problems. Most people don't know what they've done and don't give them credit for the accomplishments of the administration, and they tend to get typecast as number two men. I had done everything I could to help Al avoid those problems by giving him many high-profile assignments and making sure he received public recognition for his invaluable contribution to our successes. Yet even though he was undisputably the most active and influential vice president in history, there was still a gap between perception and reality. The biggest challenge Al faced was how to show independence while still getting the benefit of our record. He had already said he disagreed with my personal misconduct, but was proud of what we had accomplished for the American people. Now I thought he should say that no matter who became the next president, change was inevitable. The question for the voters was whether we would keep changing in the right way or make a U-turn to the failed policies of the past. Governor Bush was clearly advocating a return to trickle-down economics. We had tried it that way for 12 years and our way for 7. Our way worked better, and we had the evidence to prove it. The campaign gave Al the chance to remind the voters that I was leaving, but that the Republicans who had pursued impeachment and supported Starr were staying. America needed a president to stand up to them so that they couldn't abuse their power like that again or succeed in implementing the harsh policies I had stopped in the budget battles, beginning with the government shutdown. There was ample evidence, less than a year old, that if the voters saw the election as a choice for the future and were reminded of what the Republicans had done, the advantage would shift markedly to the Democrats. When a few people in the press began pushing the theory that I could cost Al the election, I had a funny telephone conversation with him about it. I said I was only interested in his winning, and if I thought it would help, I would stand on the doorstep of the Washington Post's headquarters and let him lash me with a bullwhip. He deadpanned, "Maybe we ought to poll that." I laughed and said, "Let's see whether it works better with my shirt on or off." On October 12th, Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif was overthrown in a military coup headed by General Musharraf, who had led the Pakistani armed forces over the line of control in Kashmir. I was concerned about the loss of democracy and urged the restoration of civilian rule as soon as possible. Musharraf's ascendancy had one immediate consequence: the program to send Pakistani commandos into Afghanistan to catch or kill Osama bin Laden was canceled. In mid-month, Ken Starr announced he was stepping down. Judge Sintel's panel replaced him with Robert Ray, who was on Starr's staff and before that had been on the staff of Donald Smaltz during the failed attempt to convict Mike Espy. Near the end of my term, Ray wanted his pound of flesh, too. A written statement admitting that I had given false testimony in my deposition and an agreement to accept a temporary suspension of my law license in return for Ray shutting down the independent counsel's investigation. I doubted that he would actually indict me, given the fact that a bipartisan panel of prosecutors had testified at the impeachment proceedings that no responsible prosecutor would do so. But I was ready to get on with my life and didn't want to complicate Hillary's new life in politics. However, I couldn't agree to intentionally giving false testimony because I didn't believe I had. After carefully rereading my deposition and finding a couple of instances in which I gave answers that were not accurate, I gave Ray a statement that said that though I had tried to testify lawfully, some of my responses were false. He accepted the statement. After almost 6 years and $70 million in tax money, Whitewater was over. Not everyone wanted a pound of flesh. In the middle of the month, I invited my high school classmates to the White House for our 35th high school reunion, as I had done 5 years earlier for our 30th. I had loved my high school years and always enjoyed seeing my classmates. On this occasion, several of them told me that their lives had gotten better over the last 7 years. The son of one of them said that he thought I had been a good president, but the most proud I ever was of you was when you stood up to that impeachment thing. I heard that often from people who had felt helpless in the face of their own mistakes and misfortunes. Somehow the fact that I had just kept going struck a chord with them, because that's what they had had to do. At the end of the month, a Senate filibuster killed campaign finance reform again. We marked the 5th anniversary of AmeriCorps, in which 150,000 Americans had now served. Hillary and I held a White House conference on philanthropy in the hope of increasing the amount and impact of charitable giving. And we celebrated her birthday with a Broadway for Hillary event, reminiscent of what Broadway stars had done for me back in 1992. I began November by going to Oslo, where the negotiations between the Israelis and Palestinians had begun, to observe the 4th anniversary of Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, honor his memory, and join with the parties in rededicating ourselves to the peace process. Norwegian Prime Minister Hjell Bondevik had decided that an Oslo event might move the process forward. Our ambassador, David Hermelin, an irrepressible man of Norwegian Jewish descent, tried to do his part by serving kosher hot dogs to both Barack and Arafat. Shimon Peres and Leah Rabin were there too. The event had the desired effect, though I was convinced that both Barack and Arafat already wanted to complete the peace process and would do so in 2000. Around this time, several members of the press began to ask me about my legacy. Would I be known for bringing prosperity? For being a peacemaker? I tried to formulate an answer that captured not only concrete achievements, but also the sense of possibility and community I wanted America to embody. The truth is, though, I didn't have time to think about such things. I wanted to press ahead until the last day. The legacy would take care of itself, probably long after I was dead. On November 4th, I began another New Markets tour, this time to Newark, Hartford, and Hermitage, Arkansas, the little town I had helped get living facilities for its migrant tomato workers in the late 70s. The tour ended in Chicago with Jesse Jackson and Speaker Hastert, who had decided to support the initiative. Jesse was looking resplendent in a fine pinstriped suit, and I kidded him about dressing up like a Republican today for the speaker. I was encouraged by Hastert's support and confident we would pass legislation in the coming year. In the second week of the month, I joined Al Fromm for the first online presidential town hall meeting. Since I had been president, the number of websites had grown from 50 sites to 9 million, and new pages were being added at a rate of 100,000 per hour. The voice recognition software that converted my responses to type is routine today, but was novel then. Two people asked me what I was going to do after I left the White House. I hadn't figured it all out yet, but I had begun to make plans for my presidential library. I had thought a lot about the library and its exhibits on my years as president. Each president has to raise all the funds to build his library, plus an endowment to maintain the facility. The National Archives then provides the staff to organize and care for its contents. I had pored over the work of several architects and had visited many of the presidential libraries. The overwhelming majority of people who visit them come to see the exhibits, but the building has to be built in a way that preserves the records. I wanted the exhibit space to be open, beautiful, and full of light, and I wanted the material presented in a way that demonstrated America's movement into the 21st century. I chose Jim Polshek and his firm as my architects, largely because of his design for the Rose Center for Earth and Space in New York, a huge glass and steel structure with a massive globe inside. I asked Ralph Applebaum to do the exhibits because I thought his work on the Holocaust Museum in Washington was the best I had ever seen. I had already begun working with both of them. Before it was over, Polshek would say I was the worst client he had ever had. If he came to see me after a 6-month hiatus with only a minor change in the drawings, I would notice and ask him about it. I wanted to situate the library in Little Rock because I felt I owed it to my native state, and because I thought the library should be in the heartland of America, where people who didn't travel to Washington or New York would have direct access to it. The city of Little Rock, on the initiative of Mayor Jim Daley and city board member Dr. Dean Kumpouras, had offered 27 acres of land along the Arkansas River in the old section of town, which was being revitalized and was not far from the old state capitol, the scene of so many important events in my life. Beyond the library, I knew that I wanted to write a book about my life and the presidency, and that I would have to work hard for 3 or 4 years to pay my legal bills, buy our home, 2 homes if Hillary won the Senate race, and put aside some money for her and Chelsea. Then I wanted to devote the rest of my life to public service. Jimmy Carter had made a real difference in his post-presidential years, and I thought I could too. In mid-month, on the day I left for a 10-day trip to Turkey, Greece, Italy, Bulgaria, and Kosovo, I hailed Kofi Annan's announcement that President Glafkos Kleridis of Cyprus and Turkish Cypriot leader Rauf Denktaş would begin proximity talks in New York in early December. Cyprus had received its independence from the UK in 1960. In 1974, the president of Cyprus, Archbishop Makarios, was deposed in a coup orchestrated by the Greek military regime. In response, the Turkish military sent troops to the island to protect the Turkish Cypriots, dividing the country and creating a de facto Turkish enclave of independence in the north. Many Greeks in the north of Cyprus left their homes and moved south. The island had been divided ever since, and tensions had remained high between Turkey and Greece. Greece wanted to end the Turkish military presence in Cyprus and find a resolution that would at least allow the Greeks the possibility of returning to the north. I had tried for years to solve the problem and hoped the Secretary General's effort would succeed. It did not, and I would leave office disappointed that Cyprus remained an obstacle to Greek-Turkish reconciliation and to Turkey's being fully embraced by Europe. We also finally reached agreement with the Republican leadership on 3 of my important budget priorities: funding the 100,000 new teachers, doubling the number of children in after-school programs, and at long last paying our back dues to the United Nations. Somehow Madeleine Albright and Dick Holbrooke had worked it out with Jesse Helms and the other UN skeptics. It took Dick longer than making peace in Bosnia, but I'm not sure anyone else could have done it. Hillary, Chelsea, and I arrived in Turkey for a 5-day visit, an unusually long stay. I wanted to support the Turks in the aftermath of 2 devastating earthquakes and to encourage them to continue to work with the United States and Europe. Turkey was a NATO ally and was hoping to be admitted to the European Union, a development I had been strongly supporting for years. It was one of a handful of countries whose future course would have a large impact on the 21st century world. If it could resolve the Cyprus problem with Greece, reach an accommodation with its restive and sometimes repressed Kurdish minority, and maintain its identity as a secular Muslim democracy, Turkey could be the West's gateway to the new Middle East. If peace in the Middle East fell victim to a rising tide of Islamic extremism, a stable, democratic Turkey could be a bulwark against its spread into Europe. I was glad to see President Demirel again. He was a large-minded man who wanted Turkey to be a bridge between East and West. I made my pitch for that vision to Prime Minister Bülent Ecevit and to the Turkish Grand National Assembly, urging them to reject isolationism and nationalism by resolving their problems with the Kurds in Greece and moving toward EU membership. The next day I made the same arguments to American and Turkish business leaders in Istanbul after a stop at a tent city near Izmit to meet with earthquake victims. We visited with some of the families who had lost everything, and I thanked all the nations that had helped the victims, including Greece. Not long after the Turkish quakes, Greece had an earthquake of its own, and the Turks had returned the favor. If earthquakes could bring them together, they should be able to work together when the ground stopped moving. My whole trip became defined for the Turks by the visit to the quake victims. When I held a young child in my arms, he reached up and grabbed my nose, just as Chelsea used to do when she was a toddler. A photographer got a shot of it, and the picture was in all the Turkish papers the next day. One of them carried it with the headline, "He's a Turk." After my family visited the ruins of Ephesus, including one of the largest libraries in the Roman world and an open amphitheater where St. Paul had preached, I participated in a meeting of the 54-nation Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which had been organized in 1973 to advance democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. We were there to support the Stability Pact for the Balkans and a resolution of the continuing crisis in Chechnya that would end the terrorism against Russia and the excessive use of force against non-combatant Chechens. I also signed an agreement with the leaders of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, committing the United States to support the development of two pipelines that would carry oil from the Caspian Sea to the West without going through Iran. Depending on what kind of future Iran chose to pursue, the pipeline agreement could prove to be of enormous consequence to the future stability of both the producing and consuming countries. I was fascinated by Istanbul and its rich history as the capital of both the Ottoman Empire and the Roman Empire in the East. In another attempt to promote reconciliation, I visited the ecumenical patriarch of all the Orthodox churches, Bartholomew of Constantinople, and asked the Turks to reopen the Orthodox monastery in Istanbul. The patriarch gave me a beautiful scroll inscribed with what he knew was one of my favorite scriptural passages, from the 11th chapter of Hebrews. It begins, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." While I was in Turkey, the White House and Congress reached a budget agreement that, in addition to my education initiatives, provided funding for more police, the Lands Legacy Initiative, our commitments under the Wye River Accord, and the new debt relief initiative for the poorest countries. The Republicans also agreed to give up their most damaging anti-environmental riders to the appropriation bills. There was also good news in Northern Ireland, where George Mitchell had reached an agreement with the parties to proceed simultaneously with a new government and decommissioning with the support of Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern. Bertie was with me in Turkey when we heard the news. In Athens, after a thrilling early morning tour of the Acropolis with Chelsea and a public expression of regret over America's support of the repressive, anti-democratic regime that took control of Greece in 1967, I reaffirmed my commitment to a fair resolution to the Cyprus problem as a condition of Turkey's EU membership and thanked Prime Minister Kostas Simitis for staying with the Allies in Kosovo. Because the Greeks and Serbs shared the Orthodox faith, it had been difficult for him. I left the meeting encouraged by the Prime Minister's openness to reconciliation with Turkey and its entry into the EU if the Cyprus problem could be resolved, in part because the two countries' foreign ministers, George Papandreou and Ismail Cem, were young, forward-looking leaders who were working together for a common future, the only course that made sense. From Greece, I flew to Florence, where Prime Minister D'Alema hosted another of our third-way conferences. This one had a distinctly Italian flavor. As Andrea Bocelli sang at the dinner, and Academy Award-winning actor Roberto Benigni kept us in stitches. He and D'Alema were a well-matched pair, two lean, intense, passionate men who were always finding something to laugh about. When I met Benigni, he said, "I love you," and jumped into my arms. I was thinking that maybe I should run for office in Italy. I had always loved it there. This was by far our most substantive third-way meeting. Tony Blair, EU President Romano Prodi, Gerhard Schroeder, Enrique Cardoso, and French Prime Minister Lionel Jospin were all there as we worked to articulate a progressive consensus for domestic and foreign policies in the 21st century and for reforms in the international financial system to minimize financial crises and intensify our efforts to spread the benefits and reduce the burdens of globalization. On the 22nd, Chelsea and I flew to Bulgaria, which I was the first American president to visit. In a speech to more than 30,000 people in the shadow of the brightly lit Alexander Nevsky Cathedral, I pledged America's support for their hard-won freedom, their economic aspirations, and their partnership with NATO. My last stop before going home for Thanksgiving was in Kosovo, where Madeleine Albright, Wes Clark, and I got a roaring welcome. I spoke to a group of citizens who kept interrupting my speech by shouting my name. I hated to break the mood, but I tried to get them to listen to my plea not to take out resentment over past wrongs by retaliating against the Serb minority, a point I made privately to the leaders of various factions in Kosovar politics. Later that day, I went to Camp Bondsteel to thank the troops and share an early Thanksgiving dinner with them. They were clearly proud of what they had done, but Chelsea was a bigger hit with the young soldiers than I was. While we were on the trip, I sent Charlene Barshefsky and Gene Sperling to China to try to close the deal for China's entry into the WTO. The agreement had to be good enough to enable us to pass legislation establishing permanent normal trade relations with China. Gene's presence would ensure that the Chinese knew that I was supporting the negotiations. The negotiations were difficult until the very end, when we got the protections against dumping and import surges and access to the automobile market that earned the support of Michigan Democratic Congressman Sandy Levin. His support ensured congressional approval of permanent normal trade relations and thus China's entry into the WTO. Gene and Charlene had done a great job. Shortly after Thanksgiving, David Trimble's Ulster Unionist Party approved the new peace agreement, and the new Northern Ireland government was formed with David Trimble as First Minister and Seamus Mallon from John Hume's SDLP as Deputy First Minister. Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness was named Education Minister. It would have been unthinkable not long before. In December, when the members of the World Trade Organization met in Seattle, violent protests from anti-globalization forces rocked the downtown area. Most of the demonstrators were peaceful, however, and had legitimate grievances, as I told the convention delegates. The process of interdependence probably could not be reversed, but the WTO would have to be more open and more sensitive to trade and environmental issues, and the wealthy countries that benefited from globalization would have to do more to bring its benefits to the other half of the world that was still living on less than $2 a day. After Seattle, there would be more demonstrations at international financial meetings. I was convinced they would continue until we addressed the concerns of those who felt left out and left behind. Early in December, I was able to announce that after 7 years, our economy had now created more than 20 million new jobs, 80% of them in job categories paying above our median wage, with the lowest African-American and Hispanic unemployment rates ever recorded, and the lowest female unemployment rate since 1953, when a far smaller percentage of women were in the workforce. On December 6th, I had a special visitor, 11-year-old Fred Sanger from St. Louis. Fred and his parents came to see me with representatives of the Make-A-Wish Foundation, which helps seriously ill children fulfill their wishes. Fred had heart problems that required him to stay indoors a lot. He watched the news and knew a surprising amount about my work. We had a good conversation and stayed in touch for some time afterward. During my 8 years in office, the Make-A-Wish people brought 47 children to see me. They always brightened my day and reminded me why I had wanted to be president. In the second week of the month, after a telephone conversation with President Assad, I announced that within a week, Israel and Syria would resume their negotiations in Washington at a site to be determined, with the goal of reaching an agreement as soon as possible. On the 9th, I went back to Worcester, Massachusetts, the city that had welcomed me in the dark days of August 1998, for the funeral of 6 firefighters who had been killed in action. The heartbreaking tragedy had galvanized the community and all of America's firefighters. Hundreds of them from across the country and several from overseas filled the city's convention center, a poignant reminder that the mortality rate of firemen is even higher than that of police officers. A week later, at the FDR Memorial, I signed the legislation that extended Medicare and Medicaid benefits to disabled people in the workforce. It was the most important piece of legislation for the disabled community since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, allowing otherwise uninsurable people with AIDS, muscular dystrophy, Parkinson's, diabetes, or crippling injuries to buy into the Medicare program. The law would change the quality of life for countless people who would now be able to earn an income and enhance the quality of their lives. It was a tribute to the hard work of disability activists, especially my friend Justin Dart, a wheelchair-bound Wyoming Republican who was never without his cowboy hat and boots. All during the Christmas season, we were looking forward to New Year's Eve and the new millennium. For the first time in many years, our family would miss Renaissance weekend to stay in Washington for the millennium celebration. It was all privately funded. My friend Terry McAuliffe raised several $1 million so that we could offer citizens a chance to enjoy the festivities, which included 2 days of public family activities at the Smithsonian Institution and, on the 31st, a children's celebration in the afternoon and a concert on the Mall produced by Quincy Jones and George Stevens with a big fireworks display. We also had a large dinner at the White House filled with fascinating people from literary, artistic, musical, academic, military, and civic circles, and a long dance after the fireworks on the Mall. It was a wonderful evening, but I was nervous the entire time. Our security team had been on high alert for weeks due to numerous intelligence reports that the United States would be hit with several terrorist attacks. Particularly since the embassy bombings in 1998, I had been focused intently on bin Laden and his al-Qaeda supporters. We had rolled up a score of al-Qaeda cells, captured terrorist operatives, broken up plots against us, and continued to urge Pakistan and Saudi Arabia to press Afghanistan to give bin Laden up. Now, with this new warning, Sandy Berger convened all my top national security staff in the White House virtually every day for a month. One man with bomb-making materials was arrested crossing the Canadian border in Washington State. He had planned to bomb the Los Angeles airport. 2 terrorist cells in the Northeast and 1 in Canada were discovered and broken up. Planned attacks in Jordan were thwarted. The millennium came to America with lots of celebration and no terror, a tribute to the hard work of thousands of people and perhaps to a bit of luck as well. Regardless, as the new year, the new century, and the new millennium began, I was filled with joy and gratitude. Our country was in excellent shape, and we were moving into the new era in good condition. Chapter 54. Hillary and I began the first day of the new century and the last year of my presidency with a joint radio address to the American people, which was also televised live. We had stayed up with the revelers at the White House until about 2:30 in the morning, and we were tired but eager to mark this day. A remarkable worldwide celebration had taken place the night before. Billions of people had watched on television as midnight broke first in Asia, then in Europe, then in Africa, South America, and finally North America. The United States was entering the new century of global interdependence with a unique combination of economic success, social solidarity, and national self-confidence, and with our openness, dynamism, and democratic values being celebrated the world over. Hillary and I said that we Americans had to make the most of this opportunity to keep making our country better and to spread the benefits and share the burdens of the 21st century world. That's what I intended to spend my last year doing. Defying historical trends, the seventh year of my presidency had been full of achievement because we had continued to work on the public's business through the impeachment process and afterward, following the agenda laid out in the State of the Union address and dealing with problems and opportunities as they arose. The traditional winding down in the last half of a president's second term had not occurred. I was determined not to let it happen this year either. The new year brought the loss of one of my old partners as Boris Yeltsin resigned and was succeeded by Vladimir Putin. Yeltsin had never fully recovered his strength and stamina after his heart surgery, and he believed Putin was ready to succeed him and able to put in the long hours the job required. Boris also knew that giving the Russian people the chance to see Putin perform would increase the chances that he would win the next election. It was both a wise and a shrewd move, but I was going to miss Yeltsin. For all his physical problems and occasional unpredictability, he had been a courageous and visionary leader. We trusted each other and had accomplished a lot together. On the day he resigned, we talked on the phone for about 20 minutes, and I could tell he was comfortable with his decision. He left office as he had lived and governed, in his own unique way. On January 3rd, I went to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, to open peace talks between Syria and Israel. Ehud Barak had pressed me hard to hold the talks early in the year. He was growing impatient over the peace process with Arafat and was unsure whether their differences over Jerusalem could be resolved. By contrast, he had told me months before that he was prepared to give the Golan Heights back to Syria as long as Israel's concerns could be satisfied about its early warning station on the Golan and its dependence on Lake Tiberias, otherwise known as the Sea of Galilee, for one-third of its water supply. The Sea of Galilee is a unique body of water. The bottom part is salt water fed by underground springs, while the top layer is fresh water. Because fresh water is lighter, care had to be taken not to draw down the lake too much in any given year, lest the covering layer of fresh water becomes too light to hold the salt water down. If the fresh water were to fall below a certain point, the salt water could rush upward and mix with it, taking out a water supply that is essential for Israel. Before he was killed, Yitzhak Rabin had given me a commitment to withdraw from the Golan to the June 4, 1967 borders as long as Israel's concerns were satisfied. The commitment was given on the condition that I keep it in my pocket until it could be formally presented to Syria in the context of a complete solution. After Yitzhak's death, Shimon Peres reaffirmed the pocket commitment, and on this basis we had sponsored talks between the Syrians and the Israelis in 1996 at Y River. Peres wanted me to sign a security treaty with Israel if it gave up the Golan, an idea that was suggested to me later by Netanyahu and would be advanced again by Barak. I had told them I was willing to do it. Dennis Ross and our team had been making progress until Bibi Netanyahu defeated Peres in the election amid a rash of terrorist activity. Then the Syrian negotiations faltered. Now Barak wanted to start them up again, though as yet he was unwilling to reaffirm the precise words of the Rabin pocket commitment. Barak had to contend with a very different Israeli electorate from the one Rabin had led. There were many more immigrants, and the Russians in particular were opposed to giving up the Golan. Natan Sharansky, who had become a hero in the West during his long imprisonment in the Soviet Union and had accompanied Netanyahu to Y in 1998, explained the Russian Jews' attitude to me. He said they had come from the world's largest country to one of its smallest ones and didn't believe in making Israel even smaller by giving up the Golan or the West Bank. They also considered Syria to be no threat to Israel. They weren't at peace, but were not at war either. If Syria attacked Israel, the Israelis could win easily. Why give up the Golan? While Barak didn't agree with this view, he had to contend with it. Nevertheless, he wanted to make peace with Syria, was confident the issues could be resolved, and wanted me to convene negotiations as soon as possible. By January, I had been working for more than 3 months with the Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa and by telephone with President Assad to set the stage for the talks. Assad was not in good health and wanted to regain the Golan before he died, but he had to be careful. He wanted his son Bashar to succeed him, and apart from his own conviction that Syria should get back all the land it had occupied before June 4, 1967, he had to make an agreement that would not be subject to attack from forces within Syria whose support his son would need. Assad's frailty and a stroke suffered by Foreign Minister Sharaa in the fall of 1999 heightened Barak's sense of urgency. At his request, I sent Assad a letter saying I thought Barak was willing to make a deal if we could resolve the definition of the border, the control of water, and the early warning post, and that if they did reach agreement, the United States would be prepared to establish bilateral relations with Syria, a move Barak had urged. That was a big step for us, given Syria's past support of terrorism. Of course, Assad would have to stop supporting terrorism in order to achieve normal relations with the U.S., but if he had the Golan back, the incentive to support the Hezbollah terrorists who attacked Israel from Lebanon would evaporate. Barak wanted peace with Lebanon, too, because he had committed to withdrawing Israeli forces from the country by the end of the year, and a peace agreement would make Israel safer from Hezbollah attacks along the border and would not make it appear that Israel had withdrawn because of the attacks. As he well knew, no agreement with Lebanon would come without serious consent and involvement. Assad replied a month later in a letter that appeared to back away from his previous position, perhaps because of the uncertainties in Syria that his and Sharaa's health problems had caused. However, a few weeks after that, when Madeleine Albright and Dennis Ross went to see Assad and Sharaa, who seemed completely recovered, Assad told them that he wanted to resume negotiations and was ready to make peace because he believed Barak was serious. He even agreed to have Sharaa negotiate, something he had not done before, as long as Barak would personally handle the Israeli side. Barak accepted eagerly and wanted to begin immediately. I explained that we could not do it during the Christmas holidays, and he agreed to our timetable. Preliminary talks in Washington in mid-December, to be resumed early in the new year with my participation, and to continue uninterrupted until agreement was reached. The Washington talks got off to a bit of a rocky start with an aggressive public statement by Sharaa. Nevertheless, in the private talks, when Sharaa suggested that we should start where the talks had left off in 1996, with Rabin's pocket commitment of the June 4th line, provided Israel's needs were met, Barak responded that while he had made no commitment on territory, we do not erase history. The two men then agreed that I could decide the order in which the issues, including borders, security, water, and peace, would be discussed. Barak wanted the negotiations to continue uninterrupted. That would require the Syrians to work through the end of Ramadan on January 7th and not go home to celebrate the traditional feast of Eid al-Fitr at the end of the fasting period. Sharaa agreed, and the two sides went home to prepare. Although Barak had pushed hard for the early negotiations, he soon began to worry about the political consequences of giving up the Golan without having prepared the Israeli public for it. He wanted some cover, the resumption of the Lebanon track to be conducted by the Syrians in consultation with the Lebanese, the announcement by at least one Arab state of an upgrade of relations with Israel, clear security benefits from the United States, and a free trade zone on the Golan. I agreed to support all these requests and took things a step further, calling Assad on December 19th and asking him to resume the Lebanese track at the same time as the Syrian talks and to help retrieve the remains of three Israelis still listed as missing in action from the Lebanon War almost 20 years earlier. Assad agreed to the second request, and we sent a forensics team to Syria, but unfortunately the remains weren't where the Israelis thought they would be. On the first issue, Assad hedged, saying the Lebanese talks should resume once some headway had been made on the Syrian track. Shepherdstown is a rural community a little more than an hour's drive from Washington. Barak had insisted on an isolated setting to minimize leaks, and the Syrians didn't want to go to Camp David or Wye River because other high-profile Middle East negotiations had occurred there. That was fine with me. The conference facilities in Shepherdstown were comfortable, and I could get there from the White House in about 20 minutes by helicopter. It quickly became apparent that the two sides were not that far apart on the issues. Syria wanted all of the Golan back, but was willing to leave the Israelis a small strip of land, 10 meters, 33 feet wide, along the border of the lake. Israel wanted a wider strip of land. Syria wanted Israel to withdraw within 18 months. Barak wanted 3 years. Israel wanted to stay in the early warning station. Syria wanted it manned by personnel from the UN or perhaps from the US. Israel wanted guarantees on the quality and quantity of water flowing from the Golan into the lake. Syria agreed as long as it got the same guarantees on its water flow from Turkey. Israel wanted full diplomatic relations as soon as the withdrawal began. Syria wanted something less until the withdrawal was complete. The Syrians came to Shepherdstown in a positive and flexible frame of mind, eager to make an agreement. By contrast, Barak, who had pushed hard for the talks, decided apparently on the basis of polling data that he needed to slow walk the process for a few days in order to convince the Israeli public that he was being a tough negotiator. He wanted me to use my good relationship with Shara and Assad to keep the Syrians happy while he said as little as possible during his self-imposed waiting period. I was, to put it mildly, disappointed. If Barak had dealt with the Syrians before, or if he had given us some advance notice, it might have been manageable. Perhaps as a democratically elected leader, he had to pay more attention to public opinion than Assad did, but Assad had his own political problems and had overcome his notorious aversion to high-level involvement with the Israelis because he trusted me and had believed Barak's assurances. Barak had not been in politics long, and I thought he had gotten some very bad advice. In foreign affairs, polls are often useless. People hire leaders to win for them, and it's the results that matter. Many of my most important foreign policy decisions had not been popular at first. If Barak made real peace with Syria, it would lift his standing in Israel and across the world and increase the chances of success with the Palestinians. If he failed, a few days of good poll numbers would vanish in the wind. As hard as I tried, I couldn't change Barak's mind. He wanted me to help keep Shara on board while he waited, and to do it in the isolated setting of Shepherdstown, where there were few distractions from the business at hand. Madeleine Albright and Dennis Ross tried to think of creative ways to at least clarify Barak's commitment to the Rabin pocket commitment, including opening a back channel between Madeleine and Bouthina Shaban, the only woman in the Syrian delegation. Bouthina was an articulate, impressive woman who had always served as Assad's interpreter when we met. She had been with Assad for years, and I was sure she was in Shepherdstown to guarantee the president an unvarnished version of what was happening. On Friday, the fifth day, we presented a draft peace agreement with the two sides' differences in brackets. The Syrians responded positively on Saturday night, and we began meetings on border and security issues. Again, the Syrians showed flexibility on both matters, saying they would accept an adjustment of the strip of land bordering Galilee to as much as 50 meters, 164 feet, provided that Israel accepted the June 4th line as the basis of discussion. There was some practical validity to this. Apparently, the lake had shrunk in size in the last 30 years. I was encouraged, but it quickly became apparent that Barak still had not authorized anyone on his team to accept June 4th, no matter what the Syrians offered. On Sunday, at a lunch for Ehud and Nava Barak at Madeleine Albright's farm, Madeleine and Dennis made a last pitch to Barak. Syria had shown flexibility on what Israel wanted, providing its needs were met. Israel had not responded in kind. What would it take? Barak said he wanted to resume the Lebanese negotiations. And if not, he wanted to break for several days and come back. Shara was in no mood to hear this. He said that Shepherdstown was a failure, that Barak was not sincere, and that he would have to say as much to President Assad. At the last dinner, I tried to get Barak to say something positive that Shara could take back to Syria. He declined, instead telling me privately that I could call Assad after we left Shepherdstown and say he would accept the June 4th line once the Lebanese negotiations resumed or were about to start. That meant Shara would go home empty-handed from negotiations he had been led to believe would be decisive, so much so that the Syrians had been willing to stay through the end of Ramadan and the Eid. To make matters worse, the latest bracketed text of our treaty leaked in the Israeli press, showing the concessions that Syria had offered without getting anything in return. Shara was subjected to intense criticism at home. It was understandably embarrassing to him and to Assad. Even authoritarian governments are not immune to popular opinion and powerful interest groups. When I called Assad with Barak's offer to affirm the Rabin commitment and demarcate the border on the basis of it as long as the Lebanese negotiations also started, he listened without comment. A few days later, Shara called Madeleine Albright and rejected Barak's offer, saying the Syrians would open negotiations on Lebanon only after the border demarcation was agreed upon. They had been burned once by being flexible and forthcoming, and they weren't about to make the same mistake again. For the time being, we were stumped, but I thought we should keep trying. Barak still seemed to want the Syrian peace, and it was true that the Israeli public had not been prepared for the compromises that peace required. It was also still in Syria's interest to make peace, and soon. Assad was in ill health and had to pave the way for his son's succession. Meanwhile, there was more than enough still to do on the Palestinian track. I asked Sandy, Madeleine, and Dennis to figure out what we should do next and turned my attention to other things. On January 10th, after a White House celebration with Muslims marking the end of Ramadan, Hillary and I went to the U.S. Naval Academy Chapel in Annapolis, Maryland, for the funeral of former Chief of Naval Operations Bud Zumwalt, who had become our friend through Renaissance Weekend. After I took office, Bud had worked with us to provide aid to the families of servicemen who, like his late son, had become ill as a result of their exposure to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. He had also lobbied the Senate to ratify the Chemical Weapons Convention. His personal support to our family during and after the House impeachment proceedings was a gift of kindness we would never forget. As I was dressing for the funeral, one of my valets, Lito Bautista, a Filipino-American who had been in the Navy for 30 years, said he was glad I was going to the service because Bud Zumwalt was the best we ever had. He was for us. That night I flew to the Grand Canyon, staying at the El Tovar Hotel, in a room with a balcony right on the canyon's edge. Nearly 30 years earlier, I had seen the sun set over the Grand Canyon. Now I wanted to watch it rise, lighting the layers of differently colored rocks from the top down. The next morning, after a sunrise just as beautiful as I had hoped it would be, Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt and I designated three new national monuments and expanded a fourth in Arizona and California, including 1 million acres around the Grand Canyon and a stretch of thousands of small islands and exposed reefs along the California coast. It was 92 years to the day since President Theodore Roosevelt had set aside the Grand Canyon itself as a national monument. Bruce Babbitt, Al Gore, and I had done our best to be faithful to Roosevelt's conservation ethic and to his admonition that we should always be taking what he called the long look ahead. On the 15th, I commemorated Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in my Saturday morning radio address by marking the economic and social progress of African Americans and Hispanics in the last 7 years and pointing out how far we had to go, Though minority unemployment and poverty rates were at historically low levels, they were still far above the national average. We had also suffered a recent spate of hate crimes against victims because of their race or ethnicity. James Byrd, a black man dragged from the back of a pickup truck and killed by white racists in Texas. Bullets fired at a Jewish school in Los Angeles. A Korean-American student, an African-American basketball coach, and a Filipino postal worker all killed because of their race. A few months earlier, at one of Hillary's Millennium evenings at the White House, Dr. Eric Lander, director of the Whitehead Institute Center for Genome Research at MIT, and high-tech executive Vinton Cerf, who is known as the father of the Internet, discussed how digital chip technology had enabled the Human Genome Project to succeed.
End of Disc 18.